Hi, you reach Roscoe's recording. I can't take your call right now, nor will I ever be able to. You see, recently I had a brief encounter with Detroit's famous band, The Layabouts. So, you'd probably find me swinging from the rafters on the third floor of Fiddler's Music, hanging by my neck. My bodily functions have probably let go by now, dripping on to the second floor. But you can leave a message, and I'm sure somebody will get back to you. Thank you.
Asheville Free Media, AshevilleFM.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP out of Columbus, Ohio. Archives of the show can be heard 1 week after airing at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can contact us with questions, comments, or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. This week, we're speaking with Peter Werby, who is a longtime editor for Fifth Estate Magazine, an anarchist publication which is about to celebrate its 50th year in November. To subscribe or learn more about Fifth Estate, you can visit fifthestate.org. All the music we'll be hearing in today's show is from a Detroit band called The Layabouts, an anarchist ska punk band which formed in the early 1980s. They are made up of former members of Fifth Estate Magazine and the Eat the Rich Gang. Stay tuned for more on that. But first, some words from anarchist prisoner Sean Swain. What you say, what you say, what you say, what?
Vigorously trained to think we need government. The principal argument for the necessity of government is that it keeps us safe. Curiously, it's really the greatest threat to our safety. In the U.S., we would be safer if the military didn't exist. On September 11th, people flew planes into buildings. They didn't do that in Canada or Belgium, Finland or Luxembourg. Those countries don't have hundreds of military bases with thousands of troops all over the world. Only the U.S. The people who took responsibility for the attacks cited the injustices of U.S. military excursions and occupation as their primary motivation. Absent the military, those attackers would have had no motive, and the U.S. would have been as safe as Finland or Luxembourg. We've been vigorously trained to think that if the U.S. decommissioned its military and disassembled its nukes, someone would invade or attack. But who and why? Would a power like Russia or China waste all that gas to transport hundreds of thousands of troops across an ocean, along with food and medical supplies and bullets and bombs, in order to fight Americans house to house? Let's not forget, Americans own upwards of 200 million guns. To compare, in World War II, Germany was the most militarized nation in the world. It went broke trying to occupy Denmark, a virtually unarmed nation that was almost the next-door neighbor. So who wants to cross an ocean to tangle with a population who has 200 million guns? Exactly. Nothing here is worth that. Potatoes in Idaho, corn in Iowa, cows in Texas. Besides, in the absence of the U.S. military, both Russia and China would have other designs closer to home. It's a total falsity that the U.S. military depends Now, it's a total falsity that the U.S. military defends the U.S. from invasion or attack. If the military didn't exist, no invasion would occur. Also, contrary to the vigorously trained response, nobody would nuke the U.S. either. Nukes are expensive, there'd be no gain in nuking a state that's a non-factor, and radioactivity eventually drifts back to those who unleash it. The people calling the shots and spending the money know all this. Everyone would be safer without the provocation of the U.S. military, and its absence would permit the American people to redirect hundreds of billions of dollars. We're talking new roads, new schools, free college, the best health care in the world, and massive tax breaks. Consider, for decades the U.S. has spent more than the next 16 competing nations combined to build the most obscene military stockpile in human history. Convert that spending into something that resembles sanity for just a few years, and the U.S. might become a nice place to live. So, you might ask, if all that's true, why has no one ever done it? Excellent question. The answer is, this massive military machine creates tomorrow's enemies. That's job security for the privileged few appointed to play whack-a-mole to solve the problems they create. And it's wealth for all the multi-billion dollar corporations involved in production of bombs and bullets and in the development of new technology. But most importantly, the U.S. military provocations create the next enemy for us to fear. So we work hard and pay our taxes so our government can defeat the Nazis or the Soviets or the Koreans or the Viet Cong. The Cubans, Sandinistas, Chinese, the Russians again, the Koreans again, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and on and on. The United States and its military creates a dangerous world so that we live in constant fear, which makes us much more predictable for the privileged few who control us. That's why the government maintains a military. So, what do we need government for again? This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from Ohio Supermax Facility. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain number 243-205 OSP 878 Coitsville-Hubbard Road, Youngstown, Ohio 44505. To read some of Sean's writings and learn more about his case, check out seanswain.org.
So, hello. Would you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about what you do?
Sure. My name is Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, and I'm a longtime staff member of the Fifth Estate newspaper, not to be confused with the recent film or with the 70s disco band or anything else, like, or the Canadian CBC rate to celebrate our 50th anniversary. So we're having big doings up here in Detroit in November. For the 40th anniversary, we had the largest Fifth Estate ever published, and it had over 100 pages. It had histories by staff members that go way back. It had excerpts from articles over the 40-year period. So I don't know what we would do differently. I think it could conceivably only have a single issue, just talking what it means to still exist in print, what it still means to have a print anarchist publication, along those lines. And the theme, we have themes every issue, because way back in the day, in the early 1970s, the newspaper, the tabloid then, was a weekly. Now it comes out three times a year. And we have a theme. So we might have art and anarchy or primitivism, or this issue was anti-Marx. And we have a portion of the paper, not the entire paper, filled with essays about our particular subjects, and the rest is general articles and news and what have you.
I was scrolling through, because I think you attached a PDF of the most upcoming one, and I was impressed by the range of stuff I saw. And I've been reading Fifth Estate for a little while now, so I continue to be impressed with that aspect of the newspaper.
Well, thank you. And it's sometimes we get what's pride when it's bad? I forgot what it is. Hubris. We think, yeah, you know. But the problem is, there's not enough anarchist newspapers. I mean, we should be one of 50. Although you might say newspapers, that sounds kind of 20th century to me. They're expensive. We're facing a $3,500 print and postage bill, and you'd think, gee, we could just, like, you got a PDF of it. Everybody could get a PDF of it. Well, I don't think we would be up in the thousands of people reading it online. Also, we tend to have longer, more thoughtful essays. And I don't know, you tell me, I can't read real long pieces on screen.
Sure. And yeah, I think there's a lot to be said for having the printed word in front of us. You know, I mean, screens are so insidious. They're everywhere, and people are staring at them all the time anyway, so I don't know.
Well, it's partly aesthetic, but and sometimes I wonder, like, we have an age range. We have real intergenerational staff that goes from people in their early 20s up to people in their, one of our comrades in his early 90s. So I sometimes worry that my brain is still back in the 20th century, although it's hard to tell who your readership is unless there's some way to identify them. But I get the idea that the people that are subscribing are people in their 20s and their 30s. We have, you know, we have old timers and what have you. Some people have been subscribers for almost the length of the paper, or at least since it's been an anarchist newspaper. And on the other hand, there's been a flood of new subscribers. And I figured those have to be younger people. So the value to me of having print is on a number of different levels. Part of it is aesthetics. Part of it is getting away from the screen. There's an internal control. If we can't come up with the $3,500, we can't print the next issue. And if we can't come up with the $3,500, that means there's not enough people interested in it. So it's sort of self-checking. Is there really a sense of putting it out? Because you can put anything out on screen, and I mean, you can count how many people are visiting and what have you. But I suspect that there's not, you know, like right now, we print 3,500 copies, and we save, pardon me, 100 for posterity. So all the rest go out. And I assume that people are reading them. If you're only interested in looking stuff on your phone and somebody either tries, if you go into a store and it's there, you're not going to look at it. And if someone, we have a lot of free distro, and if someone says, here's a great magazine, and they look at you like, dude, that's, you know, what year is this? Nobody reads magazines anymore. Well, they do. And in fact, all you got to do is go to a big newsstand, and there's hundreds and hundreds of publications. But there's not enough anarchist publications. And here, stop me at any point because I could ramble on. Let me just give you one more justification for it. One of the things that we know, remember I said it was self-checking. We have to get enough money. So it means that people are committed to the publication. All those sort of hip weeklies that are around that give all the events and are kind of these usually kind of left progressive politics and what have you. People just, you know, including you and me, we look at them, we kind of just, you know, blow through them real quickly. Oh, there's an interesting article. Oh, this band's playing, you know, at the club. Maybe I'll go see them. And boom. And so it's like a publication that 70 pages of ads and 30 pages of editorial material, of which you're interested in maybe a third. So you're reading 10% of this paper, maybe gazing at the commercials or the advertisements that are there. But also at times throughout our history that we've said, okay, we're going to be about $500 short. We've got to get a benefit together. So we talk to the bands we know. We talk to a local bar owner that's in our community. And we then, you know, all assemble in one space, face-to-face. What a concept, huh?
I would be alarmed if, like, an anarchist publication had any kind of advertising in it. So kudos to y'all. Yeah. I mean, just, like, welcome, like, advertising. Ugh. You mentioned the free distribution. Is it true that y'all send publications in to prison for free?
We do. That's a long tradition. We have a prisoner of the state fund that's almost exclusively now prisoners, you know, that are in prisons. But also, we used to send a lot to GIs. And, you know, people say back in the day before the day, you know, during the 1960s, the Fifth Estate used to send hundreds of papers to GIs in Vietnam. So hundreds of ones were sent over there. And also to bases here, men stationed in the United States. And we always, of course, advocated mutiny. You know, don't fight the Vietnamese. Refuse to be drafted. Refuse to be sent to Vietnam. And our next issue is actually going to be about Vietnam because it's the 50th anniversary of this miserable affair. And when the United States left in defeat, first, what do they call it, the first great defeat of American imperialism. And Congress has put aside $200 million to have a commemoration of this imperial slaughter in which the Death Star killed upwards to 3 million Indochinese. But even still, the United States lost badly, if you can consider the other side as sustaining those kind of losses. And so we want to revisit that to subvert the narrative, if you will, the official narrative. That's what the so-called alternative press of the 1960s, of which the Fifth Estate was one of the founding members in 1965, and of the 500 regularly appearing newspapers that lasted till about 1972 or 1973, the Fifth Estate is the only one left. You know, you say, Doesn't that make you proud? No, I wish there was the other 499.
What do you think is what do you think contributes to the Fifth Estate's staying power, as it were?
Well, it's actually kind of easy to figure in the oddest way. It's sort of an accident of geography, just being here in Detroit. So we had a situation, or there was a situation, when I always mark the end of the 1960s as 1972, when Richard Nixon was reelected, this war criminal who was responsible for the deaths of at least a couple million of the people gets reelected overwhelmingly over a tepid peace candidate. This guy, George McGovern, ran for the Democrats. And people had been, young people in their teens and early 20s mostly, had been on anywhere from a 7 to 10 year activist phase that was relentless because of everything. I mean, when you look back in history, you see what was happening during that period. There wasn't any time to breathe. I mean, it was like hands up, don't shoot, I can't breathe every single day. Like those movements now have, at least, not completely, but the kind of activism that we saw out in the streets isn't at that level anymore. Well, that was going on like every single day. So people just almost collapsed and started getting into, I don't know, just left the movement. The forms of it, like the anti-war groups, ceased calling demonstrations. And so why did we continue? That's a good point. Let me run through that quickly in my brain. Well, we had a lot of energy. That was part of it. And we weren't quite as sapped as everyone else. But the people that were there had the bright idea of, rather than collapsing, why don't we stop being what was then called the New Left? Why don't we stop being a New Left newspaper and put out kind of a very hip weekly newspaper that had calendars of events, that took advertising, that had a lot of cultural stuff, a lot of music and the arts and film and what have you. So it actually, the Fifth Estate in the early 1972, 1973, 1974, was actually sort of the grandfather of these weekly papers, these free papers that we see all over the country now. And that lasted for a few years. And the people that were doing it were pretty okay with having radical politics also expressed, and I was back there then, so I'm one of the, the older crew. So we would do, little articles about, I don't know, May Day or something, or put in stuff about anarchism and what have you. But we were also attracted by these ultra-left politics that we're reading through Freddie and Lorraine Perlman. And I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he was an American, he probably, if he was still alive, probably give me a smack if I identified him as American radical theoretician, but for lack of a better word, let's call him that. You can go to blackandred.org and see some of his writings. And also these other European ultra-lefts, particularly Italian ultra-left. But we were reading about council communism, that didn't have anything to do with the parties, which we always saw these bureaucratic gangsters that wanted to set up police states like already existed. So we were kind of going along in parallel. We formed ourselves into a collective called the Eat the Rich Gang.
That's wonderful.
And we did a number of pranks, and we did forgeries of existing publications in which we put substitute copy. Like we were near this university, Wayne State University in Detroit, and we said the president of the university resigned. So we used the masthead of the newspaper, so it looked identical to it. We had the president resigning, and we had the words in his mouth of this whole critique of the university and how it fits into the capitalist machine and work and all of that. And people went crazy for it. I mean, the students, they had no idea. They thought it was the real thing. And another prank, there's a daily paper in Detroit. It's called the Detroit News, arch-reactionary newspaper, the enemy of the people, and which should be actually on its masthead. But we put out on an Easter Sunday, we put out a facsimile of their paper that said, Easter canceled. You know, they call a newspaper, they call Second Coming type. It's the hugest type you can get. It said, Easter canceled, Christ body found. That was the big type. Easter canceled. And we went around and put it in all the newsstands where the paper normally was. So, we were up to stuff like that. Finally, the Fifth Estate as a commercial venture, it was taking like cigarette ads, X-rated movie ads, because they were saying, hey, look, we're a weekly, we got to pay salaries, we have to pay the print bill, and which they weren't doing very much of. So this is 1975. So they said, either we got to have more staff or we're going to close up. So eight of us in the Eat the Rich gang came marching in, and they said, hey, we're your new staff. And a lot of us had worked on the paper previous. I'd started in radio and hadn't been working on it. And so these two guys that were left, they said, well, we're not sure if we want all of you. And we said, well, let's vote. So they lost 8-2. And then we said, no more salaries, no more ads at all. Those are the voice of capital. That we were going to start publishing monthly. You know, that was really a cutback. And we were going to start having these radical critiques. Not even anarchists at that point. So more of these ultra-left critiques. And then we got discovered by these elderly anarchists whose lineage went back to the turn of the century and World War One in the 1920s. So in the 1975, they're already like 80 years old, and they're these amazing veterans of these struggles and, you know, the Italian resistance during World War Two against Mussolini and all that. Then we began publishing monthly, and we said, yeah, this is getting to be too much. How about every 2 months? Then we said, well, how about 4 times a year? And now we're down to 3. But it seems to be enough for us right now.
Yeah, that seems like a pretty reasonable run. But yeah, I like it. I also like the sound of this Eat the Rich gang. I'd like to invite people to take inspiration from that if they want to.
I was going to say, one of the things we did, we put out a cookbook. As the ruling class often does, it has these dinners to congratulate themselves on what fine citizens they are. So they had, I'm loving this. I'm thinking of things I haven't thought of in a long time. They had a dinner called the Builders of Detroit. And so it was all these, you know, thieving bankers and cruel industrialists and just society dames and all this stuff. So we put out a pamphlet called To Serve the Rich. And it was a cookbook of which we took regular recipes but substituted meat of the wealthy. And I'm trying to think of one where that everybody would know. I don't know. I can't think of any right now. But in other words, it was kind of era bound. In other words, that if I said some of them, you wouldn't know who they were because they related to Detroit politics. So we all dressed up in suits and dresses, you know, and greeted them at the door saying, you know, welcome to Builders of Detroit. Here's the program. And you know, it was this cookbook with them as the protein. So that was great fun.
That is lovely. That is lovely. I love that. So it sounds like Fifth Estate had this really like vibrant, super mischievous, playful, you know, beginning, or however you want to say that. How are people who are working on Fifth Estate hoping to see it change or like evolve with time? And are there directions that you see the project taking?
Well, that's an excellent question. I think right now that the direction of the paper is controlled more by the older generation, because that just happens. And the younger people tend more to be, you know, you have inertia. When things are in motion, they stay in motion in that direction. But I think that we've got to change. I think we've got too many long, ponderous articles. A few ponderous articles are okay. And you know, and we run into people who said, do you think our articles are too long? And they go, oh no. You know, I mean, younger people. No, I read them all. But when you're editing, you actually have to make some assumptions, or you have to say, we would do better with dot, 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 dot. So we are actually in the process of integrating some younger people, people in their late 20s. I've been doing the design of it, you know, which we used to call the layout of it. And I mean, I think it's, you know, decent and readable and what have you. When you have that much copy, if you're looking at it, you can see like pages, looks like The Nation magazine, just a whole page of copy. When you have copy heavy articles or pages, you can either have a full page of copy or make the article go over that many more pages and have that many more graphics. But then there's a cost factor. Like right now, we do 48 pages. If it was laid out like a modern magazine, we'd probably need, you know, half again as many, and then the cost and the mailing costs would go up. But we have this young newspaper designer who's also an artist who's going to do the 50th anniversary cover of the Fifth Estate, who said, okay, let me show you what I can do. So I'm looking forward to this.
Are there like ideological like ways that you see them?
There's no ideological change. I mean, we're pretty hardline anarchists. And once in a while, I mean, people are kind of thinking, well, you guys are really uptight. It's either got to be your line or nothing. And I know, I mean, that may sound terrible to people, but yeah. And they said, well, why can't you have other voices? I said, because ours is just this little teeny squeak. You know, we come out 3 times a year. We have 48 pages and garbage, lies are everywhere, every minute. I don't want to put out things. I don't want to work on stuff to put out ideas that I don't agree with. I don't know if I can think of any specific example. Well, this we have this theme in this issue, our spring 2015 issue of the Fifth Estate. The theme is anti-Marx. So this one guy said, well, how about if I write a pro-Marx piece? I said, well, why don't you submit it like to, I don't know, some socialists or something like that. You know, that's everywhere.
I hear the ISO loves its newspapers too.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Yeah, for the record, I totally support a hardline anarchist newspaper project. Go on for however long. Yeah, we're speaking with Peter Werby of Fifth Estate Magazine. More after this musical break.
Of work, of watching what little remains of my freedom being whittled away by monsters and jerks. I'm tired of all those unspeakable assholes reducing the world to a bottomless pit, who think of the earth as exploitable resource consumed in excreted industrial shit. And every investor who looks at a forest
and seems to be cleared as the sight for them all. And all of the scumbags who flattened our lives out and now want to flatten us once and for all. The planets of limited nuclear exchanges, acceptable loss and affordable risk. Who straighten their ties as they leave for the office and on the way out give the children a kiss.
You spoke to this question a little bit before, but I'm really impressed by Fifth Estates being a fairly long-standing anarchist project, or like it didn't start out anarchist, but, you know, has evolved into an anarchist project fairly early on. What's your perspective on working with a project with such longevity behind it, and what do you think, apart from, you know, the obvious things like energy and commitment, or maybe that's it. What do you think goes into making projects that stick around for so long in a meaningful way?
You know, that's, I don't know, for me at least, maybe even impossible to answer, because think back to what I said earlier. There's 500 newspapers during the 1960s and the early 1970s that are so-called underground or alternative newspapers, almost all of them radical or probably what we'd call now like left progressive, but a lot of them, you know, we then were calling for the overthrow of capitalism and all of that. You know, it wasn't so unusual in those papers. So 499 of them collapse, one remains. And we had fairly unique circumstances here in Detroit, and they apparently weren't replicated anywhere else. I tell you, right now, it's pretty difficult to, like, if you said, yeah, God, that sounds like a good idea to put out an anarchist newspaper. If you right now said, as soon as I hang up, I'm going to go call my pals, and we're going to see about starting an anarchist newspaper in Asheville, which I would encourage you to do. All right, so you've got some good ideas, you've got some people, and I'm sure they're as talented and committed as people here. And so probably you could get people with a skill set to do the layout and all of that, and you'd say, how many should we print? And you go, well, you know, if you got the money, you can print 100,000, right? But then what do you do with them? You know, you have to get them out. And how do you pay for the next issue? And probably if you want to do any more than, say, a couple hundred, you're going to have to give them out for free and hope that some people will respond with donations. Although there is that aspect, which I said, hey, community, we've got this great publication, the Asheville Anarchist. Yeah, I like it. And you know, we need your support. Some bands, just what I said earlier. Can we put together a benefit to pay for our next edition? But we also have, within the Fifth Estate financial structure, we have these people that we call sustainers. And one of the things that happens to you normally, if you're, and generally this occurs more to white people from a middle-class background like myself, is as you age, you suddenly start going, oh, I'm getting more of an income than I ever even expected. I thought I was just going to be poor guy sleeping in apartments and, you know, what have you. And all of a sudden, you know, you have a job that provides you with some money. So people will donate like $100 an issue. And we have quite a number of those people. And every once in a while, someone will lay like $1,000 on us. I opened up this handwritten little small envelope, and I looked at it, and I thought it said $10. And I looked at it again, and I said, oh, my God, it's $1,000. So that's what's built into this longevity. And to start, you know, from scratch is pretty difficult, particularly in a form, print media, that most people say is either dead or dying. So I don't mean to be discouraging, but it's tough, and I don't know if I really answered your question. What I'm saying, we face some pretty unique circumstances here, we benefited from some pretty unique circumstances. And also, remember that there was, when it became an anarchist publication in 1975, the Fifth Estate had already existed for 10 years, so it actually had an office. It had production machinery. It had the manner in which then newspapers were produced. We had to do negatives and then these plates and what have you. We did all of that ourselves. We had typesetting machines. Now, of course, you can just do it online. So in other words, when we became an anarchist publication, we were already in motion.
Gotcha. Yeah, and there's never a like hard and fast recipe for success or anything like that, or longevity or what have you. I have actually heard of some small movements toward like getting back into typesetting among like younger anarchists in Bloomington and some in like the Michigan and all that stuff, or Milwaukee. So I have heard rumblings, and I've seen a few things that they've put out, but nothing in a periodicized kind of way.
Yeah. Well, my second favorite, the Fifth Estate is my second favorite newspaper. My first favorite newspaper is Slingshot. Are you familiar with that? From Berkeley?
Definitely.
It's one of the ways, not only Slingshot, and all your listeners might not know this, is this newspaper in Berkeley, California. It's been around for quite a few years, and it looks like a paper from the 1960s. They have hand-drawn headlines and funky graphics, and they use, in order to, if you want to make a border, you don't just hit the little, you know, icon on the InDesign program. You have this stuff called border tape where you actually, so you're laying it out, you're doing analog layout, and you get a positive, you wax down copy, you paste down headlines, you paste down, or I guess glue down really, graphics, and then a camera takes a photograph of it and produces a negative, which then goes on to printing plate. And I love these guys. It's wonderful.
And they also, I think, send free into prisons.
They have, I think, five times what we have. And also because they sell the Slingshot Organizer, which is a day book calendar, they actually donate like $100 a year to the Fifth Estate. So that's really
awesome.
Yeah, that's within the tradition of anarchist mutual aid. For sure.
For sure. You mentioned back talking about the history of Fifth Estate, these older anarchists who sort of got wind of y'all and started working with you. I was wondering if you could talk about some of the past folks who've worked on Fifth Estate, or like some of the folks who stand out to you, and if they, you know, left any legacies or built any traditions with the newspaper that you're particularly fond of?
Well, of course, the most vivid one of all is Freddie Perlman, this amazing thinker and writer whose maybe most well-known book is called Letters of Insurgents. And he and his companion wife, Lorraine Perlman, would print these books themselves. This is a book, I think it was over 800 pages. They opened up a print shop in Detroit in, I don't know, maybe 1969 or 1970, and began printing radical pamphlets and books with radical ideas. And now, you know, you go, hey, they're all online, or, you know, you probably go to a Barnes & Noble and get the Anarchist Cookbook or something like that. Or any, the capitalists have figured out that, you know, there's a niche for selling even radical stuff, or certainly, you know, through Amazon. But then it just wasn't available. It wasn't available at all. And just like there was nothing like the Fifth Estate newspaper, the first time I saw it, I was thunderstruck that young people were putting out a newspaper when the only people that could put out a newspaper was either the capitalist press, some unions, or unions would, and there were a few leftist papers around that were, you know, weeklies and biweeklies. But media has become, you know, so more and more accessible. But you asked me, you know, people. So Freddie Perlman, I would say if it wasn't Freddie Perlman and his ideas that animated us, where everyone else was so discouraged in the early 1970s after the collapse of the New Left and the anti-war movement, that if it wasn't for Freddie Perlman and his ideas and his unbounded enthusiasm for radical ideas, that probably we wouldn't be having this conversation. There wouldn't be a Fifth Estate. For other people, there was a guy, Andy Smith, who went by the name when he lived in Detroit and then lived in a commune in Tennessee, named Sunfrog. I don't know if you've ever come across that name. But He and others left Detroit and bought some land in rural Tennessee called Pumpkin Hollow, which was its actual name. Yeah, and it may still exist. I don't know. He's now an academic. But it actually has, if you look in the back, there's of that new Fifth Estate I sent you, there's a review he did of this. There's a show on National Geographic cable channel called Live Free or Die, and it's about primitivists, men and women who are just out living off the wild, and he wrote a review of it. Anyway, the Fifth Estate looked like it was curtains in, what would it have been, like 2000, that it was in a lot of ways me kind of holding it together, and I got offered a job in radio. I'd been in radio all my life, never made, you know, hardly any money at all. And suddenly I got offered like this big time nationally syndicated phone-in talk show on a network that was owned by the United Auto Workers and broadcast out of Detroit. So I thought, well, I can do it all. So, which I couldn't. I mean, doing these talk shows, you know, hi, you're on the air, that kind of stuff. And then talking to insane people just took up all my time. And it was about to collapse, the Fifth Estate was. And Andy Sunfrog said, I'm going to move it down to Tennessee. I'm going to take it over. I'm going to change it into a magazine, and I'm going to keep it going. And so for the next 7 or 8 years, he just did amazing work, just was able to get great writers, terrific artists, good photographers. And also, as I may have said at the beginning, he produced the 40th anniversary issue, the largest issue in terms of page numbers, 102 pages that the Fifth Estate has ever published, and an incredible assemblage of articles from the past and ones, you know, that we wrote specifically for it. But then, you know, we are about to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Fifth Estate here in Detroit in November, and we're already planning this big celebration. And one of the things that could be is, if we do this right, and I think we are going to be able to, it's going to take some work, we could be assembling the hundreds of people that have worked on this over the years, because it's one of those things, you know, that when you kind of look back on and mark like the interesting or fun or exciting or intense periods in your life, most people who worked on this publication, you know, they say that working with the Fifth Estate was one of them. And certainly it's been the joy of my life. You know, most people in Detroit know me from my public radio work, but I ran into a guy the other day, and he said, hey, you're Peter Werby, aren't you? And I go, yeah, you know, which I have no interest in being a popular public figure, but, you know, if you broadcast on radio, you are. And he said, you work with the Fifth Estate, right? And I went, yeah, because if I want to be known by something, it's because of this publication. And not we just skirted this a little, but what it is a repository of those ideas of what the Italian comrades, the Italian anarchist comrade called Ideal, the ideal, the idea of a vision of a utopian society based on anarchist principles. And since we were privileged to meet these people in the late 1970s and early 1980s, some of us were, obviously, some of us, our staff wasn't even alive then, that had this legacy from the early part of the century and through the 20s and, you know, the Spanish Revolution and the Italian resistance to fascism in Italy and, you know, the Nazis. This is, to me, important work. I mean, I am so proud to be part of it. And I think anyone who is still enunciating those ideas should be, I don't mean proud in the sense like we were talking earlier, arrogance or hubris or something, but proud of the ideas and proud to be the people that are going against the current and subverting the loyalty to the empire, which is death. I mean, every minute that people adhere to the institutions and the mechanisms of the empire, nationalism and militarism and patriarchy and sexism and racism, all of that, every minute that you're saying no to that, you're part of that process that says, I don't know, it's kind of a cliche now, you know, another world is possible, but better, you know, the better. I can't remember how to say it in Spanish, but the Spanish anarchists said, we have a new world in our hearts, and maybe it'll never be realized. And during the 1960s and 70s, everybody thought there was going to be a worldwide revolution or Age of Aquarius or something like that. You can't even get that out of me anymore, and I think that anybody that's under 50, if you said, you think there's going to be an anarchist revolution, they'd probably look at you like, you're crazy, right? But we can be anarchy, not being disruptive or or, you know, undisciplined or what have you. Because these older comrades, as we called them then, they partied, actually. I mean, I was down in Miami with them at an anarchist cena, they call it, CNA in Italian, cena, where they raise funds for what they called the publications and the political victims. And they were drinking wine and dancing and, you know, telling these grand stories of the old days. And they were a model of how you would like to see yourself, rather than, you know, say we see a lot of older people, their life is like watching television or something like that. These people were as animated by the ideas of anarchy as they probably were when they were, you know, 50 or 60 years earlier.
That's totally gorgeous. I really like that image of vibrancy, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, if not, in your opinion, you know, do you have any opinion on, like, if not revolution, then what? If folks aren't focused on, you know, an anarchist revolution, or what in your opinion are they more focused on? I tend to see a lot of despair in my own social circles as far as, like, the world goes and the directions that societies are taking. And, you know, people always talk about the collapse, like collapsism, and not so much revolution. But I wonder if you had an opinion on that.
You could give me my darkest moment, and I would say it's curtains for you. A lot of people now who I talk to in their 60s and 70s, they say, I don't wish I was young, which is really unusual, you know. I mean, older people, they see this yawning maw ahead of them, and aches and pains, and older people older than them beginning to transition. Usually you want to say, gee, I wish I was 25 again. And if you really, I don't even know if you got, I'm not in my darkest moment right now. It doesn't look good right now. I just interviewed this crusty old Earth Firster, one of the founders, who has a lot of problems with his politics, but Dave Foreman, who co-founded Earth First in 1980. And he, if you push him, he's a catastrophist for sure, which I only did a little, because his concern isn't even with humans. His concern is with as he calls them, our fellow Earthlings, the wild creatures that are being eliminated by this overpopulation, something I never subscribed to previously, but I'm beginning to understand it. There's just too many folks around and doing too much damage to the planet and put in there capitalist production that demands consumption. I mean, one of the things we talk about is wealth inequality in this country and particularly around the world. Like you and me, whatever you make, you're in the worldwide 1%, without a doubt. I mean, there's like little calculators. You can go online and find them. And if you're not in the 1%, if you're like poor beyond belief, you're in the, you know, the 3%. And the capitalists are going to figure out one time, you know, if we didn't hog all this wealth that we can't even spend, that we can't get, you know, how many gold Cadillacs can we get? You know, 10. All right. But I still got billions. What am I going to do? I bought political parties like the Koch brothers, or, you know, the way other Wall Streeters buy the Democrats. What am I going to do? They figure out, you know, if people in Africa and Asia and Latin America had a lot of money, or enough money to be consumers, they could consume our products, because capitalism always has to expand. And they don't even like it when they're making as much money as last year, because their stocks will fall if it's not an always expanding profit. So, I mean, if that happens, we don't want to see people living in such dire circumstances that, you know, now half the world's population lives in slums, mostly in the southern tier countries, and the countrysides don't even exist any longer for like subsistence farming. So everybody is just crammed into Nairobi or Rio or, you know, someplace like that. And if everybody began consuming like you and me, and compared to most Americans of my age and my income, I would say we're very, very low consumers. But even if people consumed as less than I did, if everybody in the world was doing that level of consumption, you know, it'd be all over in about 10 years. So we're at a conundrum. How do we figure to get out of this? And sometimes, this is sounding more and more dire. I think I can bring it out a little.
It's partly my fault, too.
Well, no, that's fine. So what are you going to do? It could be like Mad Max, or what was that? Book and film about the nuclear war. All of a sudden, I can't think of it. But anyway, so it's, what do you do in end days? You know, they know Jesus, so he's not going to come back and save us, right? So it's all up to us. And that's sort of the basis. I mean, the other sort of philosophy, if you will, that always has moved me is existentialism, which means you choose. Every act you choose is like a universal choice. So if you celebrate the empire, if you celebrate patriarchy and racism, that's what you're choosing for the whole world, and guarantee it's going to be destroyed. Absolute guarantee. If you support every war and you support football games and you buy everything you can, you're assuring its curtains for our species, the meeker, will inherit the world, you know, the earth, I guess. The meek will inherit the earth. It'll be the dolphins if we haven't killed all of them in the meantime. So what it means is you and me doing this, you and your comrades and friends in Asheville and me and mine in Detroit, that we have just what I, well, there you go, just what I said. There's a new world in our hearts. There's an anarchist philosophy that is based not on money but on love and by mutual respect and everything that goes along with that. And that can keep us alive emotionally unless we hit some wall of physicality. Like, did you ever see the movie Day After Tomorrow?
I haven't seen that one.
Yeah, well, it's a catastrophe film.
Gotcha.
It scares the crap out of you.
Yeah.
And you can have all the anarchy and love and whatever in your hearts. But right now, as soon as I hang up, I'm going to make another call for things having to do with the Fifth Estate. So the most important people in my whole life have all been brought to me around this anarchist political project, the Fifth Estate. And we've been fortunate. I mean, sure, there's like once in a while there's disputes and what have you. But, you know, any family has that. But it is a commitment, I guess, to, as I said, what the Italian and Spanish anarchists called the ideal that is at the center of our life. And if there's nothing at the center of your life, some people make it okay. I would think most people don't. And then that's where they get sucked into looking outside of their lives and become super patriots or super football fans or super consumers or something, just dying for something, longing for something real, something transcendent. Or some people, you know, get into religion. Religion will do that for you, but you gotta suspend a lot of credulity to think that there's some guy up there in the sky, right?
I think there's a lot to be said for building more glue between anarchists and, like, anarchist thinking, especially, you know, right now when it seems to me that, like, folks are kind of spreading apart and not finding reasons to, like, be with each other and not finding reasons to engage with the world in a group with solidarity. And I think that projects like this are really awesome for that, in addition to many other things as well.
Yeah, and if we can do it, anybody can do it. We're not very special people. But you know what happens? There are special people, and there's not special people. There's people with special skills. So when you start having a project and you say, we need, and all of a sudden someone says, you know, I could write that. Someone says, but we got to have an illustration. And they say, hey, I know somebody who really is a great artist. And they go, wow. And you know, on and on like that. But I would urge people, again, if they want to see what we're talking about, we probably haven't given our website enough. They can just go to fifthestate.org. This is the 50th anniversary of this anarchist publication. And we say the longest-running English-language anarchist publication, because there's also a Yiddish, it's gone now, a Yiddish anarchist paper and an Italian language anarchist paper in American history that I don't know if I'm going to be around to pass their record, but we're part of it all, and people can act in it.
And again, that's fifthestate.org. I was wondering if you could point listeners toward your radio project.
Yeah, I can do that. And, you know, it actually, I appreciate how you defined it, but it's my employment, which I love to do. And it's on commercial radio stations in Detroit, 3 FM stations and 3 smaller HD stations. And I interview a couple people every week. And also, I have a phone-in talk show where said people say, you know, hi, you're on the air, and all of that. It would probably come off as sort of a left progressive program. I mean, I say every once in a while, I say, look, I'm an atheist, anarchist, vegetarian. And nobody responds to that, and nobody says, well, who's going to collect the garbage if you had anarchism? Yeah. So it's not anarchy radio. It's unusual for commercial radio to have at least somebody that radical on there and an anarchist. In fact, somebody once recently called in and said, I have an on-air partner. And this guy said, you two sound like communists.
Whoa.
And so I pointed to Jolene, my on-air partner, and in unison, because we've done this before, we say, we're much more radical than that. So it's great fun. And it's a, I don't mean to sound crass, but it's a paycheck. And one of the things it does, because, you know, you're not on there all the time, you're not doing 9 to 5. I mean, most people are forced to do that. But because of class privilege and race privilege and the kind of an accident of the times, I'm able to get a salary and at the same time spend a majority of my time working on the Fifth Estate magazine. So, yeah, I'm sorry. The answer to your question is they can go to Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. And there's a link to the fifthestate.org there as well. Well, this has been great.
This has been totally wonderful. Thank you so much, Peter Werbe, for talking with me for so long.
Great.
Do you have any parting shots for the listeners of The Final Straw?
Well, yes. One of the things, one of the many reasons I'm glad that you found me was that for our 50th anniversary issue of The Fifth Estate, it'll be out in the fall, we're going to do anarchist media. And we're certainly going to include The Final Straw.
Well, I can't believe I didn't ask you this, but what does The Fifth Estate, the title, refer to?
Okay, real quickly. In the French Revolution, there were the three estates. There was the royalty, the clergy, and the common people, the first, second, and third estates. During the 1920s, some pundit said that the press, the newspapers, were so powerful in determining public policy and creating wars and what have you. They were a fourth estate. So you get it? We're the fifth estate.
Nice. Ugh. I love it.
Well, and I hate it. I mean, I wish our publication was called Anarchy, but there already is one called that. Or I wish it was called The Final Straw.
Yeah.
I love that.
You take it. No copyrights. Feel free.
No copyright. We don't do Creative Commons. People can just do what they want with it. They can, people, when they reprint our stuff, they usually say from the Fifth Estate. I couldn't care less. They could take, for all I care, I mean, be pretty dishonest, but for all I care, they could take one of my articles and put their name on it. I mean, I have no sense of ownership of that at all. By the way, the Fifth Estate, though, came from the founder of the Fifth Estate, was working out in Los Angeles in 1964, and there was a coffee house called the Fifth Estate, and that's what he named it after.
Gotcha.
So, but now, the Fifth Estate, there was a movie about Julian Assange that was called the Fifth Estate.
Mm.
And also there was a disco pop group in the 1970s called the Fifth Estate. And the CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, they started fielding something called the Fifth Estate way back, and we wrote them, say, hey, we already got the name. Why don't you find another?
There you go.
And they never responded. Maybe we should find another. Hey, but again, this has been great, and I want to just thank you so much for giving me this much time.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much for talking with me. Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP out of Columbus, Ohio. Archives of the show can be heard 1 week after airing at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can contact us with questions, comments, or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. We've been speaking with Peter Werbe of Fifth Estate Magazine about the publication's history, the condition of anarchism today, and directions the magazine might take. As always, to learn more about Fifth Estate or to subscribe, you can visit fifthestate.org. Thanks for listening, and see y'all next time. Your shanties crawl under the table. Prepare your anti-nuclear nest. It doesn't really matter what you do. You can do anything that you want. 7 minutes until impact. Patiently wait for the bomb. Now it's time to crawl into your shelter. If you are the owner of one, or grab a few beers and run up to the rooftop and catch a glimpse of the nuclear sun. Stand paralyzed in hysterical fear, or thrash and scream.